Okay, good morning, everybody. This is about 2:41, and it's October 18th. And next time, October 20th, is disaster drill day. And disaster drill starts right at 10:30. I don't know how long it's going to persist for. It might go past 11:30, which is the start of our class. But if we can start class at noon, then I'll start class at noon. Right, or maybe I can start class at 11:30. It all depends on when we can all get back from the designated areas. All right, I'm not sure. But so those of you that have the 8 o'clock lab will definitely have to be done with lab and vacate the building. And then when we can get back in, we'll have lecture. Right, so even though you can't get in the building right at 11:30, don't just take off to the beach if it's a really nice day, because we'll still have a lecture. That also reminds me that next week, I believe on Tuesday, we're scheduled for exam number 3. It's on Thursday, the 27th. Okay, so depending on whether we can hold class or not on Thursday, I'm not sure we're going to have a test next week. All right, so on Thursday I'll know. Since it's disaster drill day, I just don't know. And I need at least 2 lectures on endocrine system. So we'll just have to play it by ear, which is what we're going to talk about next. Okay? Okay, so we're on special senses, and I got my nice fancy mouse right here, which is working, which didn't work really good last time because it didn't track, and now I got a nice mouse pad. Hopefully it will track, and I'll be able to use the cursor. All right, so you see the slide. Okay, you guys, who's got a question? Who's got a good question? Sounds like a lot of you guys have questions. No good questions? Okay. I do want to point out to you, the slide on the right over here is in Blackboard under documents, so you don't have to copy this down. All right, but it has 3 of the 5 special senses: hearing, static equilibrium, and kinetic equilibrium. It might be a little bit small for those of you that are sitting over on the other side of the room, but I'll go over this after we talk about ears and hearing. All right, so let's get started with lecture, and I think we're first going to start with all the structures of the inner ear. All right, so here we see some structures of the inner ear. We see, come on mouse, we see the cochlea, which is responsible for hearing. The rest of this apparatus, sometimes we call the vestibular apparatus, it's involved with the sense of equilibrium. And we have 2 senses of equilibrium, so we could break the structure down into 2 main regions. Okay, this region right here, typically this is what we call the vestibule. It contains the utricle and saccule. These organs give us a sense of linear acceleration. All right, linear acceleration. Oh, I wanted my bottle as a prop. I brought it down, but it's not filled with water. I can make it work still. Okay, linear acceleration means that there's going to be some kind of change in velocity. If you're moving straight forward, straight backwards, straight to the side, straight up and down. But it's a change in velocity, right? If you're moving at a constant velocity, there is no acceleration taking place. So if you go from 0 to 10 miles an hour, that's called acceleration, so change in velocity. And the utricle and saccule give you orientation with respect to gravity. All right, the other part are the semicircular canals. These are involved with equilibrium, but a different kind of equilibrium. We call this angular acceleration. Another way to say angular acceleration would be spinning. So when you start to rotate or spin, these are the organs that give your body the impression that you're spinning, and then how to correct for that kind of motion so that you don't lose your balance. And all of these organs right here get connected up to the brain via cranial nerve number 8, which used to be called the auditory nerve, but now it's called the vestibulocochlear nerve, because here is the vestibule and here's the cochlea, so these structures share many things in common. So you got the cochlea, the vestibule, and the semicircular canals. And notice, how many semicircular canals do you see right here? 3. And how many planes are there in space to define space completely? There is what? There's like a transverse plane, a coronal plane, and sagittal plane. How many is that? That's 3 planes. So with these 3 planes, you're able to tell exactly which dimension you're spinning in. whether it's head over heels from right to left, head over heels from anterior to posterior, or just spinning right to left. Okay, so all three. And if you're spinning at some angle, then there will be some component in each of these three semicircular canals that will give you the sense that you are spinning. Okay, so this is the bony labyrinth that is inside the temporal bone. And in particular, anybody remember what part of the temporal bone contains these apparati for hearing and equilibrium? What part of the temporal bone? It's the part between the internal meatus and the external meatus. It is the petrous region of the temporal bone. So all of this is housed within the temporal region of the temporal bone. All right, so the sensory organs themselves are located within those bony labyrinths, and lining the bony labyrinths is a membranous labyrinth. And inside the membranous labyrinth, there's a fluid. Some actually have more than one kind of fluid, but the fluid is called endolymph. All right, so the previous slide had the bony labyrinth. There's a membranous labyrinth. And then as a part of the membranous labyrinth will be the receptor organs. Because remember, in order to perceive some kind of stimulus like linear acceleration or sound pressure or angular acceleration, you need some kind of receptor to detect that, to send it to the brain. So you got the bony labyrinth, inside that is the membranous labyrinth, and then inside that is the endolymph, and also the organs for these various senses that have receptors. All right, so the utricle and saccule, which are right here, and again, we're still in the inner ear, provide the sense about linear acceleration, and the semicircular canals for what we call angular acceleration, which is what the sense of spinning in each of these three planes. So how is this possible? Well, because the organs within these structures contain hair cells. And these cells don't really have like hair growing out of them, but it has cilia, modified cilia. And underneath the microscope, these cilia kind of look like hairs. Right? So that's why these are called hair cells. And these cilia are kind of special. We call them stereocilia. And there's one big one in the group, and we call that the kinocilium. So here I see a cell with these special kinds of cilia projecting off of the surface. And all of these are kind of connected together and bridged over here to the kinocilium. This is the one that's actually going to send information, okay, eventually to the brain. So at rest, we see a certain amount of action potentials being sent to the brain. Right? This is kind of in just the usual circumstance. But when you start to spin or when you start to move in a linear direction, these cilia can bend one way or the other. And when they bend, it's going to change the frequency of action potentials being sent to the brain, and then your brain knows if you're decelerating or accelerating or spinning or stop spinning, in the sense that there is a fluid, remember, endolymph, that will push on these stereocilia. If they bend to the right, then the kinocilium is going to be inhibited, which means then the frequency of action potentials is going to decrease. There's going to be a bigger period of time between action potentials reaching the brain. But if this kinocilium bends the other way, that's going to cause, all right, it's going to cause more depolarization, and that's going to cause a higher frequency of action potentials going to the brain. So the brain can tell if you're accelerating or decelerating or spinning or stopping to spin in one direction or another, right, due to these hair cells. So the receptor cells, what would be the name of the receptor cell for equilibrium? And it's kind of strange. It's not anything you would think of on your own. It's called these are called hair cells. Okay? They're called hair cells because of these stereocilia that poke up off of them. Okay, so I just went over this slide already. So it depends on which way the kinocilium is bent. That will either, when it's stimulated, if it bends to the left, it's going to increase action potentials to the brain. If it bends to the right, it will be inhibited. And so you probably have a pretty good idea of what's happening. So let's just say sodium channel, where I have the cursor right now. What's happening to a sodium channel? It is what? It's opening up. That's right. When the kinocilium bends to the left, it has a tendency to open up sodium channels, which then depolarizes the cell. It excites the cell. But when this kinocilium bends to the right, that closes sodium channels, right, which inhibits the cell. So there are channels that are that can be stimulated by voltage. We call those voltage-gated channels. There are channels that are open when a ligand binds to it. Here are another class of channels that actually open or close depending on how the plasma membrane is bending and deforming. Right, so there are various kinds of things. And as a matter of fact, there's probably another way that you can manipulate channels, right, to keep them closed, for instance, and that is temperature. Right, so I don't know if any of you have ever had your ears pierced, but what is one thing that you can do to your earlobe so that you don't feel that pinch when you pick it with a needle? Put ice on it, right? And that ice changes the temperature of those proteins so that they can't change conformation. So it keeps those sodium channels closed in your earlobe. So then you don't have any pain reception because those sodium channels can't open up to depolarize those pain nerve endings. Yeah. Equilibrium, I mean balance. So like, for instance, if you're sitting in your chair, all of a sudden you don't lose balance and fall on the floor, or if you're walking, you don't lose balance, right? Or if you're maybe dancing or something like that, you don't lose your balance. It's a way for your body to maintain balance so that you don't fall over. That kind of balance, so physical balance, so you don't fall on your head. Okay, so what's the receptor receptor cell? Okay, hair cells. That's right, because it has these stereocilia on them. Okay, so the utricle and saccule, remember where the utricle and saccule are? It's in the vestibule right here. It's still the inner ear. Okay, have organs that we call maculae, right? And the maculae have hair cells, and I can see these hair cells right here. Here's a hair cell with stereocilia poking up into the endolymph. And they don't poke all the way into the endolymph. What's covering these stereocilia, okay, is what we call a gelatinous membrane. So something that's kind of like jello. And embedded in this jello are otoliths. And otoliths are little crystals of calcium carbonate. So you actually have little crystals inside your inner ear for the sense of linear acceleration. And these crystals are a weight, so gravity can pull on them. And when their head is upright, in this particular example, the otoliths press straight down, and when they press straight down, they don't bend the stereocilia, right? So they're just in a normal configuration, and a normal number of action potentials are reaching the brain. But when somebody tips their head forward, okay, now this gelatinous mass has a tendency to sag a little bit because these otoliths are weighing it down. And the gelatinous mass then bends the stereocilia, right, away from their straight up position right here, and that's going to change the frequency of action potentials to the brain, and then your brain knows that your head is not in an upright position, right? And we call this linear acceleration because gravity works like linear acceleration. Another way that this would happen is let's just say that this person is in the car, and of course you're looking out the windshield, you're facing just forward with your head erect like this, and you hit the gas pedal. So what happens? That's acceleration. These stereocilia are going to bend backwards as a result of that, or you'll feel pressure on your back, right? So that's what the utricle and saccule will be able to detect, changes in velocity. Okay, because of these otoliths. So don't forget, you have these little crystals inside the ear. Okay, I talked about this slide as well. All right, so that's the utricle and saccule right here. Then the next part for equilibrium are the semicircular canals. And right at the base of every semicircular canal, there's like a little bulge right there. Right? Sometimes we call that the ampule of the semicircular canal. And this is where the organ for spinning or angular acceleration is located. What the heck is an ampule? What's an ampule? It's just a little tiny vial, right? And so that reminded somebody of a little tiny glass vial that somebody made to put maybe some medication or chemicals in, right? It looks like a little ampule. Okay, and the membranous labyrinth right, are what we call the semicircular ducts. The organ for detection of spinning is the crista ampullaris. So the crista ampullaris is inside the ampule. And within the crista ampullaris, I can see some supporting epithelial cells, but I can also see some of these cells over here. What kind of cell do I have a cursor on? Right here. You see that cursor right here and right here? What kind of cells are those? Those are hair cells again that have stereocilia. They don't have hair like you have on the top of your head, right? But there's specialized stereocilia that's connected to a kinocilium, right? And these projections, the stereocilia, project up into another gelatinous mass that we call the cupula. And the cupula spans, goes across the semicircular canals, okay? And that endolymph in the semicircular canal sometimes moves and sometimes doesn't move. And depending on whether it's moving or not, it's going to push on the cupula and bend these hair cells, which then changes the frequency of action potentials to the brain in each of those three ways that you can spin due to the three orientations of the semicircular canals. All right, so I was going to bring a full bottle. Does anybody have a full bottle? Oh, I like that bottle right there. Or I like that bottle right there. I'll give it back to you. Okay, we're going to do a little experiment. Okay, so mass has a property of inertia. And what the heck does what does inertia mean? What is inertia? It's a property of mass. Inertia just says that if there is a mass that is in motion, it has a tendency to stay in motion. But if mass is stationary, then it wants to stay stationary. It doesn't want to move. All right, so Thanksgiving is coming up, and I expect all of you to do this experiment for Thanksgiving dinner. What are you going to do for Thanksgiving dinner? Going to big table. A lot of people are going to come over, and you're going to have candlesticks, right, and wine glasses and wine bottles and all kinds of stuff on the table. And I want you to pull the tablecloth out from underneath all that stuff without spilling anything, because that's going to be a demonstration of inertia. Okay. So this bottle of water right here represents the endolymph that's in the semicircular canals. There's my cursor, right? That's the endolymph. And when it moves one way or the other, it's going to push on this cupula. Okay. So if you're standing still, right, if you're standing still, the bony labyrinth is stationary. The semicircular canals are stationary, and the endolymph is stationary as well. They're just standing still. But as you start to spin, okay, the bony labyrinth, since it's attached to the temporal bone, is going to start to move. The bony labyrinth of the semicircular canals is going to start to move. That's going to be represented by this piece of paper right here, is the bony labyrinth. And what about the endolymph when you start to move? What is its nature? What is its tendency? Its tendency is to stay put. Okay? So how does that happen? All right, so I'm going to pull the piece of paper, and this is actually pretty easy because it's not a really big piece of paper. All right, but I can move the bony labyrinth, and the endolymph is going to stay still. The hair cells are connected to the bony labyrinth. Come on, cursor. Uh-huh. Right, so as soon as you start spinning, the hair cells are spinning, but the endolymph is stationary. So this thing, right, the endolymph is going to push on the cupula, and it's going to bend the hair cells when you start to spin as a result of that. And then you're going to get the sense that you're starting to spin in one direction or another. Now, what happens if you spin for a long period of time? What's going to happen to that endolymph? Like if you start to spin for a long period of time, the endolymph is going to start to move catch up to the bony labyrinth, right? It's going to start spinning at the same velocity as your body is. And then what happens when you stop all of a sudden? The bony labyrinth stops, but what about the endolymph that's inside of it? It's going to want to keep going, right? So let's do that same kind of experiment right here. So the water is endolymph, and the paper is the bony labyrinth. So you start spinning, and then all of a sudden you stop quickly. What happens to the endolymph? It wants to keep moving. And when it keeps moving, again, it's going to bend this cupula the other way and then deform these stereocilia and you'll get that perception that you're actually spinning even though you're stopped. And I'm sure you all used to do that when you were little kids, or maybe some of you even last night, right? So when you stop, you see the room spinning around you even though you're not spinning, right? Because the endolymph is still, it has inertia and it's still spinning within the semicircular canals. I think I got that from you. Thanks. Okay, so that's the semicircular canals. And that's in all three planes that you can spin in. All right, and we call that angular acceleration. Sometimes angular, the sense of angular acceleration is what we call kinetic equilibrium. The sense of linear acceleration is what we call static equilibrium. And we see that over here on this slide. Static equilibrium is linear acceleration. Kinetic equilibrium is for angular acceleration or spinning. Okay, ears and hearing. What the heck is hearing all about? What's the kind of energy that you can perceive with your ears or hearing? It is just pressure. It's physical pressure waves that increase and decrease around atmospheric pressure. So sometimes the variation is very fast, sometimes it's very slow, and we can measure the rapidity of that change is by looking at the frequency of that particular wavelength, right? And it's measured in cycles per second. The faster that waveform changes, the higher the pitch. The slower that waveform changes, the lower the pitch that we perceive. And we measure it in cycles per second. Sometimes we call that a hertz. And usually we can perceive sound anywhere from a change in 20 cycles per second up to 20,000. All right, so that's the range of pretty much normal hearing. And pitch is just directly related to frequency. So as the frequency increases, what happens to pitch? The pitch increases as well. All right, now the intensity or loudness is directly related to the amplitude of the waves. As the wave amplitude increases, then it sounds louder, and as the amplitude decreases, the sound gets softer and softer, and we measure that in decibels. All right, so here is a really nice picture of the whole ear. You can see the outer ear right here, including the external acoustic meatus. The line of demarcation between the outer and middle ear is the tympanic membrane. All right, so anything deep to the tympanic membrane is the middle ear, including these auditory ossicles. And these are just really small bones, and I could keep all three right between my fingertips right here, and you couldn't tell that I had them or not, because that's how small they are. And the job of the tympanic membrane is to vibrate back and forth when sound pressure enters the external acoustic meatus. Right, so then when the tympanic membrane vibrates, the vibrations go through these auditory ossicles, the incus, malleus, and stapes. Here's the stapes, kind of looks like a stirrup. And that's the end of the middle ear, which is the beginning of the inner ear. So here is the structure, these are the structures of the inner ear, including the cochlea, which we haven't talked about yet, kind of looks like a snail, the vestibule, which we just got done talking about, and the semicircular canals. All right, so which one of these three structures in the inner ear are responsible for hearing? Is it the cochlea, vestibule, or semicircular canals? And that's the last one that we haven't talked about yet, and indeed that is true, right? So the cochlea is responsible for hearing, and it sends action potentials via the vestibulocochlear nerve right here as well. All right, so the way that sound pressure waves enter the cochlea is through the oval window. There's a membrane right underneath the foot of the stapes right here. Can you see what's this footprint of the stapes? Does it look like? Does it look like a triangle or a square or a circle? No, I haven't hit it yet. Okay, you better tell me. What does it look like? It looks like an oval. That's right. It looks like an oval. See that footprint? And right underneath that footprint of the stapes is what we call the oval window. All right, so it's a membrane, and when the stapes vibrates back and forth, that introduces sound pressure into the cochlea right here. All right, there's another window, and it's called the round window. I don't think I see it. Maybe this is it right here. Oh, it is labeled. Okay, round window. So sound energy enters the cochlea, and that could damage the cochlea if it gets trapped in there, but there is another window right here with a membrane over it that can vibrate back and forth that releases the sound pressure in the cochlea so nothing damaging takes place. Okay, maybe from anatomy, you can also remember there are some muscles in the middle ear right here, so when sound gets really, really loud, these muscles contract and then some and can dampen the amount of energy, decrease the amount of energy that enters the cochlea, right, and that protects the cochlea as well. The other thing is this tube right here, the eustachian tube. This should equalize the pressure in the middle ear with the outside world, right, because we want this tympanic membrane to vibrate back and forth right around atmospheric pressure so that if we had high pressure in the middle ear, that would push the tympanic membrane all the way out and then it couldn't vibrate. It would just be stationary. It would be stuck in one position. Or if there would be low pressure in the middle ear, the tympanic membrane would move all the way, right, toward midline and wouldn't vibrate either. And under those circumstances, you can't hear anything. Or if you have an infection of the middle ear and it gets filled up with fluid and maybe even pus or something, right? That's going to distend the tympanic membrane and it can't vibrate. And then what happens to your sense of hearing? You can't hear very well either, right? So this tympanic membrane's got to vibrate back and forth to send those vibrations through these auditory ossicles into the inner ear. All right, so that's a nice picture of all of the structures of the ear for the three senses, static equilibrium, kinetic equilibrium, and hearing. So here is a nice illustration. You might wonder, why does the cochlea look like a snail? Okay, so let's look at the cochlea. So here is the cochlea with some internal organs also illustrated, and we've unrolled it. All right, so here's the tympanic membrane. Here's the malleus, incus, and stapes. And maybe in lab, you have an otoscope, you can look through the tympanic membrane. You can even see the malleus right here. All right, here's that oval window. And the oval window introduces sound into the endolymph. And this top chamber right here is called the scala vestibuli. So sound enters the scala vestibuli. And eventually it's going to end up right in the scala tympani right here and then leave via the round window. But to go from the vestibuli into the tympani right here, it's got to pass through the organ for hearing. And that organ for hearing is called the organ of Corti. So this right here is the organ of Corti, and here is another chamber, which is what we call the cochlear duct, and it's filled with endolymph. And depending on what part of the organ of Corti is stimulated, you'll hear a different frequency. So for instance, here we see at the close to the helicotrema, which is the end of the cochlea, this is responsible for low frequencies. Right? In the middle part of the organ of Corti, we see that that's going to give you the perception of mid-range frequencies, and the part that's very close to the tympanic membrane over here, if these cells get excited, it's going to give you the perception of high frequencies, right? Because remember, pitch is directly related to frequency. Here we have 500 hertz, that's low frequency, 2000 is like a mid-range, and high frequency, a high pitch sound would be up by 20,000 hertz, right? So that's a big range. So when I look at the cochlea all unrolled like this, it reminds me of a musical instrument, and probably reminds you of a musical instrument too. What kind of musical instrument does this look like? What does that look like? Yes?
Actually,
let's answer that question first. Let's get back to your question. Otherwise, I'm going to forget what question I'm asking. All right. What musical instrument is this? If you pound one end of it, okay, it makes a high frequency. If you pound the end of it, it makes a low frequency. Drum? I don't know if I see a drum in there. Okay, but I like the drum here for this tympanic membrane. But a drum usually just plays the same kind of note. Maybe you can mess around a little bit with it to change the note. Piano or xylophone, a piano for sure. So you have a piano in your ear, in the petrous region of the temporal bone. Depending on what part gets excited, right, you're going to hear low frequencies, or if it's this more proximal part over here, you're going to hear high frequencies. That's exactly like a piano. All right, now why is the cochlea all rolled up? How come it's just not nice and linear like this? How come that cochlea looks like a snail? Well, to save space, right? Because otherwise you'd have like these pianos sticking out of your head and it could get knocked off, right? So it's just rolled up to fit into that small space, right? So that's an easy thing to understand. Okay, so sound, so why does a piano, when you hit one end of it, make a high frequency, and if you hit the keys on the other end, it makes a low frequency? What's special about a piano? It has to do with the strings, right? So the high frequencies are produced by really thin, narrow strings, or short, narrow strings, and low frequencies are produced by, what, really long, thick strings. So the shape of the strings, and even the tension on those strings, changes what how they behave, their frequency of vibration. The same thing for the cochlea. This end of the cochlea, even though it's kind of like the inner part right here, this is the thickest part. If you were going to look down from the top, this would be the thickest part. The helical trema is the thickest part, and the thinnest part is over here by the oval and round window. So this part just has a natural tendency to vibrate at a high frequency. This part over here has just a natural tendency to vibrate at a low frequency. So when sound comes in, it passes from the vestibuli into the tympani right here, depending upon how it matches up with the shape of the organ of Corti. The thicker means low frequency right here. Okay, your question. Or did I answer it already?
I got it.
Okay. So now let's look in some detail of these ducts. So here's the vestibuli. This is connected to the oval window. Here's the tympani. This is connected to the round window. And sound has to pass through, right, from vestibuli into tympani right here. When it does, it passes through the cochlear duct. And that sound energy can then also vibrate this little gelatinous mass that we call the tectorial membrane. Are you kind of familiar with gelatinous mass? Where have we seen that before? In the vestibule for linear acceleration and the crista ampullaris for angular acceleration. Well, here's that same kind of junk right here called the tectorial membrane, and it's going to vibrate according to its particular dimensions, right? If it's a big, long, thick piece, then low frequencies will excite. If it's really thin and short, then high frequencies will excite. It's going to vibrate up and down. And then what do we see in this region right here? This is the organ of Corti. And look at these cells. They're kind of small. What do they have? Stereocilia. So these are actually what? Hair cells. These are the same kinds of receptor cells that we see in the maculae and the crista ampullaris. Here are some hair cells, and they get bent when the tectorial membrane vibrates up and down. Right? And so that changes, that is going to release or inhibit neurotransmitter that excites these cells right here, which then send action potentials to the brain. So here, these are just kind of a review from anatomy. Here is the basement membrane, here's the tectorial membrane, and in between is the organ of Corti. Oh, here's even a better picture, right? So here are the hair cells, you can see the stereocilia. Here is the basement membrane, here's the tectorial membrane, and this tectorial membrane vibrates when sound passes from the vestibuli into tympani right here, and then here is the vestibular cochlear nerve that's going to take those action potentials to the brain. Yeah. Oh yeah, semicircular canals,
yeah,
for angular acceleration.
Not sure. Anyway,
okay.
Why is it like as we get older, we only lose that sense of high frequency hearing? Is it because it's so close to the tympanic membrane, or is that just because of something else entirely? Is it weaker there at that point?
Yeah, it's damage to the organ of Corti. But how that happens to high frequency, and it's true, it happens more to high frequencies than low frequencies. And it just so happens that high decibel sound, loud sound, damages the high frequency cells more than the low frequency cells. So I would guess that when you attend a concert, there's just more energy on the high end of the spectrum compared to low energy, right? But if you were going to be in an environment that has high energy, low frequencies, it would damage your low hearing as well, okay? And I know a lot of guys that were in the Navy, and way back when, they didn't have to wear a lot of ear protection, and there was a lot of noise, especially around 60 cycles per second, because that's how power is transmitted through the boat, that they would lose their hearing around 60 cycles per second. okay, because that's how energy is transferred around. So depending on what kind of energy enters your ear and what the amplitude is what's going to cause damage to that particular part of the ear. Okay, so that might help answer that question. Okay. Oh, is what caused by?
Vertigo.
Vertigo. Oh, you know, we have very poor understanding, at least I have a very poor understanding of vertigo and tinnitus and things like that. But vertigo would not be due to damage to the cochlea, but it would be due more to the vestibular apparatus or semicircular canals. It could be the hair cells, but it could be even nerve damage. It could be maybe even a viral infection of the vestibular nerve, and which just messes up the afferent signals going to the brain. Okay, so we don't understand if it's just a general inflammatory process. It could be maybe an autoimmune disease, could be an infectious process, or maybe could be due to all kinds of different reasons in different people. Yeah, so that would be dizziness. But dizziness can also be produced by different kinds of medication as well, especially those that affect blood pressure. Okay, can give you a sense of vertigo. But if it's due to an infectious process, it's going to be, oops, let's go back, it's going to be due to an infection of what, the inner ear, not the middle ear. Middle ear infections are very common. We call that otitis media. But an infection of the inner ear, which would cause vertigo or loss of equilibrium or balance, right? That would be a labyrinthitis. Okay, so a different kind of condition. Most likely a viral infection, which should be taken pretty seriously because of what's right on the other side of this external acoustic meatus right here. All your brain is right there, right? So if that isn't controlled, that could produce, I'm sure, some kind of encephalitis or something, and that could be really dangerous. So, yeah, any kind of inner ear infection should be taken really seriously. Okay, so here is the pathway to the brain from the organ of Corti, right? This is cranial nerve number 8, goes into the medulla oblongata, typical kind of cranial nerve entry into the central nervous system. And you can see most of the fibers decussate over to the opposite side of the medulla and then arise into the corpora quadrigemina, and in particular, this one right here is the inferior colliculus, and this part of the brain allows you to localize sound, right? So the inferior colliculus allows you to tell where sound is coming from, because if it's coming from the right, it's going to reach your right ear before your left. The inferior colliculus will know that, and then your brain will know that the sound is coming, for instance, from that side of your body. So if somebody walk through this door and closes it, or that door, or one's up at the top of the class, you can tell even with your eyes closed, right, because of the signal processing that takes place in the inferior colliculus. Okay, then here is a second order neuron that goes to the thalamus, and remember that from anatomy, the thalamus is a relay station for all sensory information before it proceeds to the cerebral cortex. And when you have depolarizations in the cerebral cortex, that's what gives you the perception of reality. So even though the thalamus depolarizes, or the inferior colliculus depolarizes, you don't really have a sense of what that sound is. Those action potentials actually have to reach the cerebral cortex, and the auditory cortex is in the temporal lobe. So here is the primary auditory cortex, and the auditory cortex, I think you have a picture in your book, that shows that it's arranged by frequency as well. It's the same kind of arrangement as in the organ of Corti. So high frequencies will cause depolarizations here, or depolarizations in this part of the cortex will give you the perception of high frequency. Depolarizations or action potentials reaching this part will give you the sensation of the other kind. What did I say over here? Low frequency, so high frequency right over here. So actually, what do you have in the temporal lobe laid out on the cerebral cortex? You have like another piano right there. Okay, and depending on which ones of these depolarizes, then you'll hear a particular frequency. But maybe you'll hear three frequencies. So what is going to be your perception if you have a depolarization here, here, and here? What do we call that in music? Anybody ever study music? What do you hear? What do you call that when you hear three tones at one time? That would be a chord, Okay, for instance, and the spacing of those notes then tells you if it's a pleasant tone or a dissonant tone or whatever. Okay, so you have these pianos in your temporal lobe, but they're not curled up like the cochlea. Okay, these are nice microscopic structures. Okay, vision. That takes us to vision. Our last sense. Oh, you know what? Before we do that, let's look at the slide over here on the right. So I got structures and functions of the special senses of the labyrinth. What part of the ear is the labyrinth? Inner ear, right? And don't forget that's in the petrous region of the temporal bone. What are the three senses in the of the labyrinth? What are the three senses that you have up there? You've got hearing, okay, and balance, two kinds of balance. Static equilibrium, what's the same thing as static equilibrium? Linear acceleration, a change in velocity with just a linear direction, which means what? Straight direction. And then the third one is kinetic equilibrium. What's another name for kinetic equilibrium? Angular acceleration, or you could say spinning, right? So the inner ear is responsible for all those. Of these three senses right here, hearing, static equilibrium, and kinetic equilibrium, which do you need an external ear for? Yeah, you have to have your pinna, got to have external acoustic meatus, right? But those things don't affect your sense of equilibrium one way or the other, right? That's only for hearing, all right? What do you need your middle ear for of the three senses? You need it hearing. Again, you have to have those auditory ossicles carrying vibrations from the tympanic membrane over to the oval window. But again, it has no bearing on your senses of equilibrium. Right? Senses of equilibrium are due to motion of endolymph or the motion of otoliths on that gelatinous membrane of the maculae. Okay. And what about the inner ear? Which senses are dependent on a well-functioning inner ear? All three, right? So you need all three. All right, so what is the bony labyrinth for hearing? That's the cochlea. That's the snail-like thing. And the bony labyrinth for static equilibrium is the vestibule. And the bony labyrinth for kinetic equilibrium are those semicircular canals. Okay? All right, and inside the bony labyrinth is a membranous labyrinth. All right, and that membranous labyrinth for hearing is called the cochlear duct. And for the semicircular canals, it's called the semicircular ducts. But for the vestibule, it's the utricle and saccule, those two little places right there. And the receptor organ, you should know. Receptor organ for hearing is the organ of Corti, right? And the receptor organ for static equilibrium are the maculae, that's plural. And then the crista ampullaris for kinetic equilibrium. Now, what about the receptor cells and these receptor organs? Who can tell me the names of the receptor cells? They're all hair cells. And that probably is pretty amazing, right? Because it's the same receptor cell which gives you what kind of perception of reality? Totally different depending on what organ they're incorporated into. Sound is totally different compared to your sense of equilibrium. Totally different to your sense of spinning, right? But it's the same cell that has been, that has evolved to give your brain different kinds of information. So they're all the same receptor cells. All right. Anybody have a question on the three senses of the inner ear? No? Hearing, static, and kinetic equilibrium. All right. That takes us to vision. And vision, you have cells that can respond to waves, but these waves are different than pressure waves. These are electromagnetic waves. Kind of like radio waves and TV waves and things like that, microwaves, but a little bit different wavelength. So the frequency is a little bit different. So what we see on this slide right here is what we call a spectrum. It's just a plot of wavelength, okay, versus these different kinds of waves. And visible light is right between infrared, which is sometimes what you use to keep food warm, right, and ultraviolet light, and even higher energy like x-rays and gamma rays. Ultraviolet light, right, comes from the sun, or maybe certain kinds of lamps can produce ultraviolet light. I know in the aquariums I have some ultraviolet light. Because what can you tell me about ultraviolet light? The wavelength is shorter. It is high energy. It's damaging to life. right? So when you go out in the sun is producing ultraviolet light. If that ultraviolet light touches your skin, right, that can damage your skin and cause cancers like melanomas or squamous cell, right, carcinomas, right? And our eyes can't see ultraviolet light, so you can't just go outside and see if it's, you should be wearing sunblock today or not. But what do you know? What should you do? You should wear clothing or sunblock anyway, no matter what time of year it is, because sunlight is very damaging to the skin. So your eyes can see visible light. Okay, here are the wavelengths right here. But these different wavelengths are, correspond to changes in energy. So low energy is on the right-hand side, high energy is on the left. So red is pretty low energy. Blue light is, has more energy associated with it. Okay, and your eyes can see these different colors right here. So this is just looks, these are just colors of the rainbow. And if you want to memorize these colors, there's somebody's name that you can write down on a piece of paper to tell you what color comes next to which other color. What, does anybody know the name of that person? Roy G. Biv. Okay, so R-O-Y, then G. So green should be where? Pretty much somewhere in the middle of the spectrum. And then we've got what? Blue, indigo, and violet. Okay, so that might help you sometime know the colors of the visible light spectrum right here. Okay. All right, so the eye is kind of a special organ because it has to adapt to light intensity. Sometimes, like right now, when the room is really dim, okay, our pupils are dilated, so a lot of light can enter so that you can see. If we walk outside, all right, the iris is going to constrict and the pupil is going to get very small. It's going to block a lot of light to protect the retina. All right, so the iris is the pigmented muscle. It controls the size of the pupil. The pupil constricts by contraction of circular muscles. That's under parasympathetic control, and dilates via contraction of radial muscles. So here is the iris right here. So in, and I can see circular muscles. Can you see this deep layer right here? These are circular muscles, and then this layer right here are the radial muscles. So depending on which one contracts, it's going to cause a change in pupil diameter. And so here we see sympathetic stimulation going to the radial muscles, right? So dilation is via contraction of the radial muscles. When they contract, when they get shorter, it pulls on the circular band, which makes the pupil bigger. So in dim light, okay, the sympathetic nervous system causes dilation. Or under periods of stress, what happens to your pupil diameter? Like if you're for sure going to get run over on the freeway by a big semi-tractor trailer, your pupils get really dilated, okay, as a result of contraction of these radial muscles right here. All right, but in bright light, parasympathetic stimulation takes over, okay, and parasympathetic nerves go to these circular muscles, causing them to contract, causing constriction of the pupil right here, letting less light into the eye. All right, so this is, pupil diameter is controlled by the two effects of the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system. All right, so, and you got to know this is what? The iris of the eye. Okay, accommodation is a little bit different. You should at least go over the anatomy of the eye in lab. I know you went over the anatomy of an eye in anatomy lab extensively. All right, I don't have a picture of the eye. I don't want to go over that in lecture. But what allows for accommodation is the lens. The lens helps focus light on the retina, which is in the posterior part of the globe of the eye. Okay? And the lens, at least in younger people, can change shape because it has to change shape in order for you to see things far away or close up. So by itself, the lens won't change shape, but it's attached to a muscle. And that muscle is called the ciliary muscle that surrounds the lens, and the ciliary muscles attached to the lens by these suspensory ligaments. Probably should have been named suspensory tendons, because what's a ligament? It's a bone-to-bone connection, right? So it's a little bit of a misnomer, but don't get off track with that. It's still called the suspensory ligaments, right? And so accommodation is the process that allows you to focus on something that's very close to you as opposed to far away. All right, and we can do a nice experiment right now. Like, take your index finger and stick it out right in front of your face and look at the tip of your index finger. Focus on the nail on your index finger and tell me, what about all the objects behind your finger? Do you see them? Are they in focus or out of focus? They're out of focus. Now, move your finger, keep your finger there. Sorry, don't move your finger. Keep it there. And now focus on somebody that is far away from your finger. And they're in focus. What can you tell me about your finger? It's out of focus. As a matter of fact, it's so out of focus, I see two separated by about that much. Okay. So you can't focus on every distance from you. You pick one distance, right? And we call that process of accommodation. And that means that the lens has to change shape, right? And that's going to be controlled by this ciliary muscle and connected by the suspensory ligaments. All right, so how does this happen? It's not really intuitive how it happens. As the ciliary muscle, right, relaxes, right, it expands. When the ciliary muscle expands, it gets bigger, that's when tension is applied to the suspensory ligaments. Usually you think when a muscle contracts, that's when tendons, right, apply pressure to bones and bones move, but not in this particular case, because when the circular muscle relaxes, that's when tension is applied to these suspensory ligaments, and that's when the lens gets pulled on the most, when the muscle relaxes and it becomes flat, it flattens out. All right. So on the other case, okay, when the ciliary muscle contracts, the circle gets smaller right here, which releases tension on the suspensory ligaments, and that allows the lens to get thick. Right? So the lens is going to change the curvature and the thickness depending on the state of contraction of that ciliary muscle right there. Okay, which is going to change what distance you focus at in front of your face. All right. And unfortunately, there's an age-related effect. Okay, as we get older, this lens gets harder and harder and harder, and so it doesn't like to change shape. So you might only be able to see close up, but not far away, or far away, but not close up as we get older. All right, so that reminds me of thinking of somebody driving down the freeway. Say maybe they're driving, and maybe it's an elderly person. How fast are they driving? Are they going fast? Very seldomly do you see an elderly person driving fast, right? They're usually really slow, and you probably wish they wouldn't even be on the freeway, right? But you have to get on the freeway sometimes in Southern California, okay? And why is it they're driving so slowly? Because they can no longer accommodate, right? So they can either see things close up or far away, or maybe they can see both, but it takes a longer period of time for their lens to change shape. All right, so if you're an elderly person, what's one thing that you don't ever want to do? Say you're 70 years old. You don't ever, well, drive at night, but you don't ever want to get a ticket because what's going to happen most likely? Oh, you're probably going to lose your license, right? And then you're going to lose the ability to drive and all kinds of fun stuff like that. So you don't ever want to get a speeding ticket. So that's one reason why they drive really slowly. So if you don't ever want to get a speeding ticket, where do you have to look? You have to look at your speedometer, and the speedometer is really close to you, okay? And so you have accommodated for looking up close, so you're driving under the speed limit, so you're not too anxious, but you're on the freeway, last place you want to be. What don't you want to miss? You don't want to miss your exit, right? So you look up from the speedometer, which is close, to down the freeway to look for your exit, and when you look down the freeway, guess what you see? Nothing. It's just a big blur because the lens hasn't changed shape yet. So everything's blurry for 1,000, 2,000 seconds, right? And then all of a sudden it pops into focus and you see your exit down there and you go, oh, thank goodness, I didn't miss my exit, right? Because then I go into a weird neighborhood that I don't even know, right? All right, so you're relaxed, but then all of a sudden you're hit with this wave of anxiety because now what are you worried about? You haven't missed your exit yet, but you could be speeding. How do you know? Look at your speedometer. You look at your speedometer, and what do you see? It's just a blur because it takes a while for that lens to change shape, 1,000, 2,000, 3,000. Speedometer comes into focus, and now you're relaxed again. You're not going to get that speeding ticket. Oh, but wait, another wave of anxiety hits you. Because why? Oh, you might miss that exit. And you look down the freeway, and what do you see? Nothing, just blurriness, right? So anyway, if you see any of those viejitos driving on the freeway, just what, stay away from them, give them a lot of room and be patient with them because they just don't see as well as we do, right? Because of what's that process of looking at things close up and then far away is what, accommodation due to changing of the shape of the lens, and that's controlled by this ciliary muscle right here. Okay. Visual acuity, allowing you to see. We see that the lens plays some role in that, but that is allowing you to see things either close up or far away. There's something else on the eye that has curvature. So here I see the lens, but there's something else that light passes through that has curvature, which helps you focus. And that is the cornea right here. Here's the cornea. It's the outer epithelium, right? On the anterior pole of the eye, it has curvature, and actually it plays a more important role in focusing light than the lens does. The lens just allows you to change your distance of focus, right? But it's the cornea that really does most of the job of focusing light on the retina, which is right on the posterior pole of the eye right here. Okay, so visual acuity has to do with resolving power of the eye, which means its ability to separate two closely spaced objects out. And most visual acuity for people is maybe around 1/10 of a millimeter, about 1/10 of a millimeter. So you know what a millimeter is on your ruler. If the lines on a ruler get closer than 1/10 of a millimeter, they look like one line. Okay, if they're farther than 0.1 millimeter apart, you can actually tell that they're two lines. That's what we call resolving power. And so different people, depending on the shape of the eye, have different ability to focus or resolve closely spaced objects, and we can use lenses to improve that. So if somebody has emmetropia, which is normal vision, it means that the shape of their eyeball is such compared to the curvature of the lens and the cornea so that when light enters the eye, it focuses exactly on the retina, right? It's not all spread out. And if that's the case, then you don't need any corrective lenses or glasses because you have pretty much perfect vision at this point in time. Okay, myopia, on the other hand, means that the shape of the eye is a little abnormal. It's a little bit long. So light focuses in front of the lens, right? So we call this nearsighted. So the object is focused in front or nearsighted in front of the retina right here. When somebody is not myopic, they can actually see things close up but not far away. Okay, so this nearsightedness has to do with where these light rays converge. And for myopia, it's what? In front of the lens. So that can be corrected pretty easily by using a concave lens, which actually spreads the light out a little bit before it enters the eye, so that when it's overcorrected by the cornea and the lens, it now focuses right on the retina right here. Okay, so that's myopia. Another kind of problem is maybe if somebody's eyeball is too short. Okay, so light is actually focusing on the outside. It goes all the way, it doesn't actually pass through, but this is the point where it would focus if it could go all the way through the eye. And this is what we call farsightedness. All right, so this means farsighted means somebody can see things far away but not close up, okay, when this happens. So to correct this kind of vision, then we need to use a convex lens that starts bending these light rays together before it enters the eye, right, so that they actually then converge on the retina. All right, so that would be hyperopia. And then astigmatism, don't forget our eyes are not just flat like this, it's really what a three-dimensional sphere. And maybe you have really good vision on the right, but not the left, right? And if that's the case, then you have an astigmatism, where if you look at a flat object, maybe a part of it will be in focus, but not the other part. Maybe the top part, but not the bottom part. Or maybe the right part will be in focus, but not the left part, if it's in one plane. And so we call that astigmatism. And so then we need an aspherical lens to correct light rays in one part of your visual field, but not other light rays that are coming in. All right. So that's visual acuity. All right, let's look at the retina for a little bit. It's really hard for me to imagine that we're going to have a test next week, but let's keep going. The retina. The retina is, how many layers does an eyeball have? If you're going to break, three, it's got three. What's the outermost layer? Which is the white part, that's the sclera. Then the middle part is called the choroid, right? And then the deepest part is the retina. And the retina has photoreceptor cells. Oh, here we got, right here. All right, so here's the sclera. That's mostly connective tissue that partly determines the shape of the eye. Oh, I tell you what, I need to go back and talk about this just a little bit because it's kind of fun. Okay, so here we see that changes in the shape of the eye changes your vision, right? That's kind of a nice structural functional relationship right there. And what can you tell me about the shape of your eye and maybe the shape of the orbit over your lifetime? It changes, right? And your vision changes over your lifetime. And as a matter of fact, when you're younger, you might be myopic, but by the time you're elderly, okay, you could be emmetropic. Some people's vision actually gets better as they get older. Okay, most people's vision gets worse, but sometimes it actually does get better. It all depends on the shape of the orbit and the shape of the eyeball. And then surrounding every eyeball is a lot of periorbital fat. So I suppose, you know, even how much adipose tissue in your body can change your vision because it's going to change the shape of the eyeball. All right, there's a very popular surgery out right now that's called LASIK procedure. And remember we said the cornea plays an important role of how light is focused on the retina. And that process where a laser actually burns away some cells of the cornea and it changes the shape of the cornea so that it matches up now with the distance from the retina to the cornea. And it's a pretty cool surgical procedure because it takes maybe a second or less, right? And a lot of people are really happy with it because if you can't see things far away but not close up, now it can give you almost perfect vision for far away. And it takes place in just a second or so. But I have some concerns because what kind of surgery is this? It seems really simple because it's right just on the surface of the eye. You're not digging around and surgerizing any deep structures like the lens or the retina. But it still is a surgery, and what can happen with any kind of surgical procedure? Yeah, something could malfunction, right? Which means then your vision will be really messed up. But here is something else. As we get older, okay, because our lens doesn't accommodate very much anymore, okay, it's more and more difficult for elderly people to see things close up, like to read a book or to use a cell phone or something like that, if they're wearing glasses. So if I'm wearing glasses to see far away, but I want to read a book, maybe like around age 45 or 50 or something, what do a lot of people do in order to see close up when they're wearing their glasses? Okay, they just take their glasses off, and now they can see really normal close up, but they can't see far away. All right, so the trade-off is far vision. When I'm wearing glasses, I have really nice far vision, but my near vision is kind of messed up, so what do I do with my glasses? Oh, I just take them off and now I have good near vision, right? Or you can wear bifocals or progressive lenses or something, so you just change what part of the lens you're using. But if you get that LASIK procedure that gives you very far, good far vision, okay? This has happened to a lot of people. I had a lot of friends going to get a LASIK procedure and they can see beautifully as they walk out of the doctor's office, and then they get a phone call and they get their cell phone out of their pocket and they look at their cell phone and guess what? They can't see anything. They can't use their cell phone because they've sacrificed their near vision for far vision. All right, so there's a trade-off. And if you have glasses, it's easy. What can you do? Just take your glasses off and answer your cell phone. But if you have LASIK procedure, you can't undo it to use your cell phone. Okay, so that is another complication with that LASIK procedure. So if you elect to have that done, make sure you go talk to a really reputable physician that will explain all these different things to you, right? Because it still would be really good to be able to use your cell phone. Okay, so when we get back, we're going to start talking about the retina next time on Thursday.